Forget the first time my junior high school teacher threw a curveball at me. First time I ever saw a curveball, you know, right at my head. I dove. It broke over. He laughed. I went, "That's not fair at all." And couldn't hit that. Could never pick it up.
The first time I saw a curveball was in 1986, standing behind the batting cage at Dodger Stadium, watching Sandy Koufax break Dusty Baker's bat. It was 20 years after.
I was just talking to Juan Marichal about, in 1964, Koufax and Marichal are pitching against each other. And Marichal's the batter. And Koufax threw that big overhand curve that started head high, and Roseboro, the catcher, would catch it in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And Marichal started his swing. He had two strikes on him. He started his swing up here because the ball was up there, and he swung straight down and broke his bat on home plate. And Marichal was and I were laughing about it a little while ago.
That's funny. That's funny.
It was so funny.
Ready? Go, John.
Okay. Like to pick up in 1949, and we understand that Brent Rickey got you together with George Sisler to, as I've read, to help establish an acquaintance with the strike zone. Can you talk a little bit about working with George?
Well, I was a free swinger. You know, if the ball looked halfway decent, I took a cut at it. I don't think I wasn't up there to get a walk. I was up there to hit the ball, and I really didn't know my strike zone. Everybody has their own strike zone.
Right.
And I would swing at pitches eye high, and I'd swing at pitches, some of them almost in the dirt, things like that. So Branch Rickey took me to Vero Beach, Florida, brought me in from the Dominican Republic where we had spring training in 1948, and I went into a batting cage, and a pitcher would throw pitches to me, and I'd stand in there without a bat in my hand, just like I was holding a bat, but I'd stand in there like so. And I would take every pitch, and then I would umpire. There would be an umpire there and a catcher. Branch Rickey and a couple, George Sisler and a couple other guys would be in back of the cage. And I had to call every pitch. And it was amazing how many times I was wrong, that being a strike or a ball. And I'd have to do that every day for a while. Then they would put a bat in my hand, and then I'd hit every pitch. Curve balls, fastballs, whatever. And after I would hit every pitch, well, I took some because they were definitely balls because it was live pitching. But after I'd hit the ball, then I had to tell Branch Rickey that pitch was outside and it was about knee high. And it was amazing how wrong I was. I had to learn location of the pitch, whether it was a striker or not, but they emphasized with me, be ready to hit every pitch until you see it's a pitch you don't want to swing at. So that taught me to be, instead of what they say in Little League a lot of times with the kids, be ready to, don't swing at it till you see it's a strike. Well, if you tell a kid that, you take the aggressiveness out of it.
Right.
They didn't want to take out my aggressiveness. They just wanted me to be more aware of which pitches were hittable and which weren't. And so I eventually, it took a couple of years, but I eventually learned the strike zone to where I'd get close to 100 walks every year.
Wow.
And not up there trying to get a walk. If the first pitch looked good, I was not told to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the first pitch is the best pitch you get to swing at all day. So be ready to hit every pitch until you see it's a pitch you don't want to swing at. That way you're ready to hit all the time.
Did you get
that
a
was
sense?
Good advice. Mm.
Did you get a sense that was like, this is make or break? You had been up and down in 47, 48. This was the make or break?
I think I became pretty much a major league hitter in 1948. I came back up from Montreal in August and started getting more hits and swinging the bat a lot better. But 1949, I had a decent year. Hit 290 something and 23 home runs, I think, or something like that. Okay. Anyway, I was on my way right there. But I had a dismal World Series. Okay. I dreamt since I was so high that I was going to play in a World Series and play against the Yankees someday. And there I was in Yankee Stadium, first game of the World Series in 1949, and Allie Reynolds, hard-throwing right-hander for the Yankees, was going to pitch. And they introduced us, and we got up, and we went out and lined up along the third baseline. They introduced the batting order. I was hitting third. Well, when they called my name, and I went out by the line, I stood there. My knees were shaking. I couldn't swallow. I looked around. There were 60-some thousand people in Yankee Stadium, and I couldn't swallow. And I says, uh-oh. I hadn't had this feeling before. And Reynolds, when I come up to bat, Reynolds would throw me those high fastballs, and the harder he threw, the harder I swung. And I didn't make contact. He struck me out three times in that game. Mm. And I set a World Series, I tied a World Series record in 1949. I struck out eight times in five games and only got three hits in the World Series. So I was very disappointed in myself because I was trying too hard in the World Series and I wasn't myself. I hadn't learned to relax in a real pressure situation like that. And the next years came along, we didn't get back into the World Series till 1952. But I came home after the 49 World Series, we got beat 4-1. We weren't ready to really compete and be as good as the Yankees, maybe not beat them, but be as good as. And we got beat 4-1. I went home and my hometown gave me a big dinner, welcome home dinner. We were being the first guy from the Compton area to get in a World Series. And I apologized to my friends that were there. I said, I want to apologize to you all for the dismal World Series that I had because I tried to be somebody that I wasn't. I wasn't myself. And I said, if I ever get in the World Series again, I'll make it up to you. They gave me a nice watch and a couple of presents and things like that and a nice dinner. And they were happy that I got in the World Series and made it to the big leagues. Well, 51, we got beat in 1950, we got beat the last day of the season by the Phillies, and 51, we lost to the Giants in the playoffs. And so 1952, we got back in the World Series, and I hit four home runs in that World Series in 52. So I was a major league hitter then. And that first home run I hit in that World Series was off Allie Reynolds. And I don't remember going around the bases and touching the bases. I must have been about that high.
Wow.
When that ball went over the right field fence. Because I said, I'm there. I'm there.
You also, 10 hits, 4 home runs in that series.
Yes, I had a very good World Series. Yul Blackwell was one of their pitchers, and Johnny Sain, I hit those guys pretty good. And we were very competitive in that World Series. In fact, I think the 1952 Brooklyn team was the best team I played on.
Okay.
We lost the World Series in 7 games, but we had a set player in every position, and we had a very good pitching staff and just a solid ball club.
Now, lesser known, Richie Ashburn single-handedly burns you guys on the last game of the season in 50. But 51 ended even more dramatically. We can't skip over that series.
Well, Richie Ashburn threw Cal Abrams out at home plate. We went into the final weekend of the season playing the Phillies, the Whiz Kids they called them. We called them the Fizz Kids. But we played the Whiz Kids, and they had a good ball club. They had a good bunch of good players, nice guys. Ashburn was a center fielder. And I came to bat in the 9th inning, score tied. And Abrams was on second base. Pee-wee Reese was on first base. And no outs. And so I went over to our manager, Bert Schotten, and I said, Bert, you want me to bunt him over to second and third? He says, no, I want you to get a base hit and let's get into a playoff with these guys, and they're one game ahead of us. Let's get into a playoff and we'll beat them and get into the World Series. And this is 1950. And I said, okay. And first pitch Robin Roberts threw me, I hit a line drive, base hit to center field. And Ashburn was playing kind of shallow because they all thought I was going to bunt. Wow. And I went over to shot and I said, you want me to bunt him over? No, I want you to get a base hit, drive him in. So I hit a line drive and it was a base hit, but Abrams took a little step back towards second because it looked like the ball might be hit right at the second baseman, sort of. And so he took a step back, and by the time he got to third, Ashburn had the ball and already had it on the way in. And our third base coach made a very serious mistake. He sent Abrams in, and he was out from here to Broadway. I mean, he was out by a long ways, and the throw was not that good. The throw was up the third base line and off line to home plate. But with the bad start that he got, he was out. Well, Peavy went to third. I went to second on the throw, and they walked Jackie intentionally to load the bases. And then we had Hodges and Ferrillo were the next two batters. Well, Ferrillo was hitting ahead of Hodges, and Ferrillo popped one up with the bases loaded and one out, and we were behind 4-2 at the time. Mm. And I'm talking about World Series now. I think I got off the track, didn't I?
You did go to extra innings. Sisler right. won on a home run.
Pardon?
Sisler won the game on a home run against
in
the 50. Phillies. In
yeah, 50. See, I screwed that okay. up. We're going to have to do it over.
That's fine.
That's fine. Just do it over.
Just do it. Richie throws out Abrams at the plate, okay. but you do end up in extra innings.
And then Dick Sisler hit a home run in the 11th inning to beat us, right.
Right.
And I thought I was going to catch that ball, and there's sort of a wind tunnel in left center field in Ebbets Field, and the ball just carried into the first row of the seats, and we got beat by one run. But we could have easily gotten the World Series that year, but we didn't.
Did the Dodgers go down at the last day of every season, or did it just seem that way?
Just about.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Just about the last day of every season or the last game of the World Series. Seventh game.
How nerve-wracking was that?
Well, it made things kind of interesting. I mean, one thing about it, we learned early in our careers that a game in April might win the pennant for us in September.
Yeah.
So just give it all you got in the April, just like you might need to do in September or October.
Can you talk a little bit about the next season now, 1951, and you guys have a big lead, and you're heading into looks like you're heading into another meeting with the Yankees, and why don't you pick it up there?
Well, 51 was an interesting year for us. We were starting to come into our own after finishing strong in 1950 and losing to the Phillies in the final game, but. We got it into August, and we had a 13.5 game lead. Mm. And it appeared that if we'd have played a little bit better than 500 baseball, that under normal circumstances, we would win the pennant. But the Giants won some 38 out of their last 46 games, and that was phenomenal baseball. So we actually, most people say we blew the pennant that year, but I think the Giants won the pennant that year mm-hmm. by finishing as strong as they did. And we got into the final game, and the Giants had already won in Boston by playing the Braves. And they had won, so we had to win to get a tie now. And Jackie made a great play, and then he hit a home run. And we won that ball game, and we have to come back to New York for a three-game playoff. Against mm-hmm. the hated New York Giants. Mm-hmm. And we played the first game and got beat. Branca pitched it. And we got beat, I don't know the exact score, but we got beat. And we went to the Polo Grounds to play the next two games. And Clem Labine shut them out 9-0 in the second game. Mm-hmm. And in the third game, we're ahead 4-1 going into the ninth inning. And you could almost count your money. But like Yogi said, it's never over till it's over.
Right.
And it certainly wasn't over because the Giants came back and a couple of C&I base hits. And pretty soon Newcomb was pitching and Newcomb got tired. And so they took him out. They brought in Branca. Now there's a cute story involved in that. We had three pitchers warming up in the bullpen. We had Preacher Rowe, Carl Erskine, and Ralph Branca. Now Thompson hit a home run off Branca in the first game. But anyway, all three guys were throwing. And our manager called down to the bullpen. They have a phone on our bench and a phone in the bullpen. And they said, "How are they throwing?" He said, "Well, Preacher Rowe can't get loose. And Carl Erskine just bounced a curve in the dirt. And Branca's throwing okay." He said, "Well, bring in Branca." So Ralph came by me and I wished him the best as he went in to pitch. Thompson's going to be the batter. He warmed up and first pitch, strike one. The next pitch he threw up in here and Thompson hit a line drive to left field. And in the Polo Grounds, it's very short down the lines, 245 feet or so, about a 20-foot wall out there. And so my job as a center fielder in that situation with a couple of runners on base, or any time the ball's hit out that way, is to run over towards left field and get the ball bouncing off the wall, the top of the wall, and throw it in so that you might hold the guy to a single.
Mm-hmm.
But at least he'll get a double. But if you don't go cover over there, he might get a triple. And he was a winning run. So I was running over to protect keeping the winning run as far away from home plate as I possibly could. And all of a sudden, the ball disappeared over the fence. And I didn't break stride. I just made a U-turn and went about center field where the clubhouse was, where our dressing area was. And I saw all the newspaper men, all the cameras, all the champagne being picked up and taken over to the Giant clubhouse. And it sort of hit me then, but it really didn't hit me until Branca came in. And he came in and he laid on the steps. It was a two-tiered clubhouse with about 8 or 10 steps. And he was laying on the steps and he's saying, "Why me? Why me?" And I transferred my hurt feelings about losing the ball game to feeling sorry for Ralph the way he was taking it. Because if I'd have got a base hit on September 6th to win a game instead of popping it up or something, we wouldn't have had to go to the playoffs. We would have won by one game. So it was all our fault that we didn't win a game here or a game there. It wasn't his fault because he gave up that particular home run, because that game, if one of us had come through in the right situation, that game would have never been played.
I can't imagine anyone handling it with more class than he has over the years.
Ralph has gotten better each year about handling it. In his earlier years, he wasn't handling it very well. None of us were.
Right.
But you know what we finally got together one day, we're talking about it in spring training, the next spring, in 52. And we started talking about it and says, "Hey, look," he said, that's going to make us better baseball players to go through something like that after the Sisler home run, to take this one on the chin, going to make us better players. We'll get them next year." Well, we did. We won in 52, we won in 53, we won in 55, we won in 56. The next 4 out of 5 years, we were in the World Series. So it made better players out of us, but we didn't realize it at the time.
If it had been any team other than the Giants, it seems that the Brooklyn Dodgers' history is inextricably linked with the Yankees, the Giants. There might as well have not been baseball in any other part of the country. Could you talk about baseball in New York, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke, the fame and the fortune of those three teams?
Well, I think the media made the hype of Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. The three of us were center fielders and playing in the same city. But we were all having outstanding years. And so the newspapers in the afternoon would compare our averages and what we did the night before and everything else, and made a big hype out of it, because there were a lot of afternoon papers then.
Okay.
There's not, mm-hmm. I don't think there's any now. Or, but they had to write features, because the morning paper covered the game, the afternoon paper would be, there'd be feature writers, and they jumped on this Willie Mickey and the Duke comparisons, and none of us had any pressure on us as far as the comparisons were concerned. I could care less what Mays and Mantle were doing. I was quite concerned with what the Giants were doing, but I didn't look to the box score and see how many hits Mays got or anything. There was no personal battle there. It was just a team battle. That's what it was.
Did that come together more because of the song, or
the song
was
didn't
it
come out until a baseball strike after we all three retired.
Right, mm-hmm. right. But when you were playing, the comparisons were there because of the afternoon papers, though.
Yes.
Okay.
The comparisons, it made good printing, good reading, and made things quite interesting, because the three of us were in the top 10 and in the league and practically all the departments, and we were all having excellent years. But our teams were having good years too, because the Yankees won the pennant. We won the pennant, or come close, and the Giants either won the pennant or were in second place. So it was quite competitive as far as the teams were concerned, but not individuals.
So what was
I was just happy to be compared with those two. I said, heck, if I'm compared to those two, I'm a pretty good ball player.
Wasn't there a stretch 7 years, I believe, that one of the three teams ended up champion?
I would think so. Yeah. I don't know that to be a fact. But right. Either the Giants, the Yankees, or, well, we only won it once in Brooklyn, so.
Yeah, the Braves in 57 stopped the string.
Oh, okay.
In L.A., we won it in 59.
Right. Yankees won in 58.
We beat the White Sox in 59.
A few years ago, during the player strike, 94, the series was killed in 93. We had the New York baseball writers brought Willie, Mickey, and the Duke in to receive the first Willie, Mickey, and the Duke award. And Mickey said that he had been asked the question about 500,000 times, who was the best. And he said that he was going to answer that it was Willie, but he didn't mind being tied for second with you. So, not to put you on the spot, but is it possible to compare the three of you? And
no, I don't think you can compare the three of us. We could all run. We could all throw. We could all hit. And we could hit with power. And we were all above average center fielders. So I would say that in a given year, I might have been, numbers-wise, might have had more numbers than one of the other two guys. Another year, they might have had them. We were very close during the course of maybe 4 or 5 years in that particular period. We were pretty close, and we were on very successful teams.
Okay.
And that was the important factor as far as all three of us were concerned. Was
you hit with more power in that period.
I hit more home runs in the 50s than the three of us.
Okay.
But
did it feel
not
like
by much? I don't think it's by very much. What are numbers, you know?
They're
going to be changed, so things are going to change. Be different numbers up there for somebody else.
Now, shortstops hit 50 home runs.
Yeah, right.
With as successful as the three teams were, did it feel like that being in New York was the center of the baseball universe, that this was baseball?
Seemed like it. I mean, in the 50s, from 49, and for the Dodgers anyway, 49, 52, 53, 55, 56, and in L.A., 59, we were in the World Series. So for the Dodgers, we were in, and we lost to the Phillies. Lost the Phillies on the last day of the season, lost to the Giants in the playoffs. That's two more that we could have been in. I wouldn't say should or anything else, but we could have been in two more World Series there. So we were pretty much on top of it like the Yankees were when they won five World Series in a row.
The Yankees won the series, but you don't hear about a Bronx Yankees love affair. You don't hear about Upper Manhattan Giants love affair, but you always hear about Brooklyn and the borough and the Dodgers and how they embraced each other. What made life in Brooklyn so special?
I think it was just the success that the Brooklyn organization had on the field and the love affair that the fans had with the players and the closeness of the borough as far as the team was concerned. You don't hardly ever hear about the New York Giants anymore unless it's football. But you do hear about the Brooklyn Dodgers still. And of course the Yankees just keep going on and on. They're baseball. They're the top franchise in baseball. I don't know. It's just that the fans fell in love with us, and it was a love affair because I could hardly wait to get back here to start the season because it was home. As far as baseball was concerned, Brooklyn was home. And when the team moved west, I didn't want to move to Los Angeles. I was born in Los Angeles, but I didn't want to move there. I wanted to stay in Brooklyn as far as baseball is concerned.
Okay. And before we lose the Brooklyn Dodgers and move to L.A., could you go position by position and talk about that? Those are special teams, but the primary players.
The 52 team, I thought was the best one I played on.
That would be fine.
Roy Campanella, I don't need to say anymore. Three MVPs, outstanding catcher, great handler of pitchers. In fact, he told Erskine one time, he said, Carl, he says, you just listen to me and throw what I call for. Says, you're right. You'll be all right. You'll win a lot of games. And so Erskine lost a close game 2-1 one night. And he called through whatever camp he called for. And he says, Roy, he says, I lost last night. He says, in the paper it said LP Erskine. He says, why don't, if you're so good, so much in charge, why don't they put losing catcher Campanella? And it brought a laugh from everybody, like it did with you. But Campanella was the ultimate. He was a team player, a nice guy, and Super Bowl.